So for today's special service, we come together to celebrate something that many of us love and hold dear, books. I, for one, love books. They have always been one of my favorite things in life. I love the feel of a book. I love the smell of a book. I love brand new books on sale for the first time, and I love old books. Those pages have a special feel and smell. The memories of books from the past and the enjoyment I have experienced in the reading all open up in my mind as I hold that volume. I love ancient books, 100 years old or more, the paper now yellowing and fragile. You can get a sense of all the hundreds, if not thousands, of people who have read that book before. You are now part of a mental community that stretches back generations. Books can transport us. Books can lift us up out of depression. Books can educate and illuminate, entertain and transform. A well-written book can make you feel things. Love and fear, terror and victory, pride and prejudice. They can convey truth, pain, and an amazing grace. Today we will hear about some favorite books, and we will give and receive the gift of books. If you haven't already, if you have brought a book for our book communion, please come forward and place them on the altar. And I love that we have so many wonderful looking books, and there's room down below, and we can even keep going if we run out of room down there. So now let us come together and worship together this morning. And now we are going to enjoy hearing some testimonials from a few people about my favorite book. First of which, please invite up Renee Castle.
Good morning. My name is Renee Castle. The book I've chosen to read from is The Phantom Tollbooth by Norton Juster, illustrated by Jules Pfeiffer. This has been one of my favorite books since I was a child because it has wonderful wordplay and makes you think. This story is about Milo, a boy who doesn't know what to do with himself, not just sometimes, but always. He doesn't see the point in learning and is bored with his life. One afternoon, he found a strange package in his room, which contained a small purple toll booth. He assembled it, randomly chose Dictionopolis as his destination, dusted off his electric car, and entered the lands beyond. During his journey, Tok, the watchdog, and the humbug became his companions and joined his quest to rescue the princess's rhyme and reason from the castle in the air. Here is just one of the many places he visited. Is the end of it, not the beginning of it. Do many people live here in the forest? Asked Milo as they trotted along together. Oh, yes, they live in a wonderful city called Reality, he announced, smashing into one of the smaller trees and sending a cascade of nuts and leaves to the ground. It's right this way. In a few more steps, the forest opened before them, and off to the left, a magnificent metropolis appeared. The rooftops shone like mirrors, the walls glistened with thousands of precious stones, and the broad avenues were paved in silver. Is that it? Shouted Milo, running toward the shining streets. Oh no, that's only illusions, said Alec. The real city is over there. What are illusions? Milo asked, for it was the loveliest city he had ever seen. Illusions, explained Alec, are like mirages. And realizing that this didn't help much, he continued, and mirages are things that aren't really there that you can see very clearly. How can you see something that isn't there? Yawned the humbug, who wasn't fully awake yet. Sometimes it's much simpler than seeing things that are, he said. For instance, if something is there, you can only see it with your eyes open. But if it isn't there, you can see it just as well with your eyes closed. That's why imaginary things are often easier to see than real ones. Then where is reality? Barked Tok. Right here, cried Alec, waving his arms. You're standing in the middle of Main Street. They looked around very carefully. Tok sniffed suspiciously at the wind, and the humbug gingerly stabbed his cane in the air, but there was nothing at all to see. It's really a very pleasant city, said Alec as he strolled down the street, pointing out several of the sights, which didn't seem to be there, and tipping his cap to the passers-by. There were great crowds of people rushing along with their heads down, and they all appeared to know exactly where they were going as they darted down and around the non-existent streets and in and out of the missing buildings. I don't see any city, said Milo very softly. Neither do they, Alec remarked sadly, but it hardly matters, for they don't miss it at all.
So Glenn is not a cruel man, but he asked me to choose a favorite book. After a couple of weeks mulling this over, I'd almost come to a conclusion that the book I will not be talking about today is Moby Dick. It has the reputation of being my favorite book because I will strongly defend it against any and all accusations that it is outdated, verbose, or boring. But I was talking to my stepfather about this great book decision of 2018, and he pointed out that a book about killing whales might not go down so well with the UU community. Fair point. Dead white male writing about a killer white whale. I will only say, in its defense, that Melville does have, to quote our mission statement, a profound reverence for nature. I was also chatting with Reverend Bria Christina this week about choosing a book for the service. As a limiting factor, maybe I could choose my favorite female author, my favorite science fiction book, a translated book, something to get the diversity flowing. But I also, like I do, mentioned Moby Dick, and that I own 4 editions of the book. She wanted to see this. So I have brought my 4 Moby Dicks, which are heavy. It's not a short book. My first time reading Moby Dick was the autumn before I started graduate school for Victorian literature, so I figured it was past time to read this classic. If you decide to read or reread Moby Dick, I highly recommend autumn, winter evenings, preferably cold, starry nights. That's the time to do it. I have my Norton Critical edition. I'm a huge fan of Norton Critical editions. They have scholarly articles, maps, all of the real word nerd stuff. If you have a favorite book, it's worth picking up a Norton Critical. This one is for pure beauty and the joy of its rough cut pages, which if anyone wants to come and pet my book after the service, you're more than welcome. I also have the board book for Moby Dick with helpful advice for children, such as Captain. Better to sail with a moody good captain than a laughing bad one. But I'm not talking about Moby Dick today. Now that I have that out of my system, I decided that for today I would choose a nonfiction book. It's been my goal for a while that roughly a quarter of the books I'm reading should be nonfiction. In the last year, I've read about eels, taxidermy, witchcraft, superheroes, coffee, Hinduism, Native Americans, and the American postal system. But which nonfiction is my favorite? Walden? Is that too obvious? Still too white 19th century? It was hugely influential in my childhood and is still a favorite. So I'll use one of its opening lines to introduce the book that I chose for today, which is not Moby Dick. Thoreau writes, "Alert and healthy natures, remember that the sun rose clear. It is never too late to give up our prejudices. No way of thinking or doing, however ancient, can be trusted without proof." So, without further preamble, the book that I chose for today is Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory by Caitlin Doty. Caitlin is a Los Angeles mortician, writer, and social media personality, known for her advocacy work in rethinking Western death practices and alleviating modern death anxiety. She's a leader in the death positive movement, which believes, amongst other things, that the silence surrounding death should be broken through discussion, gatherings, art, innovation, and scholarship. But I didn't know this when I picked up the book in 2016. Fair warning, as nonfiction set in a crematory, this can be a tough read. Tough, but empowering. And truly quite funny, especially if your sense of humor bends that way. My initial review of the book, while I wouldn't go so far as to work in a crematory, this is exactly how I feel about death. From my love of medieval skeletons to life-affirming acceptance of my own mortality, it is beyond time to be asking questions about and coming up with better solutions for interacting with death and the dead. There are some difficult truths and horrifying details, but I'd recommend it to everyone. Caitlin is my death hero. She still is. And since then, it's been a deep dive into eco-burials, advanced directives, hospice, other death cultures, which she writes about in her second book, From Here to Eternity, and social justice. Violent and lonely deaths are disproportionately experienced by the marginalized. There's so much to think about. My particular interest in celebrating death is celebrating aging and death, and I'm considering becoming a humanist celebrant, or perhaps someday a chaplain, all because of this book and the death positive movement. I could talk about books and death all day, but in conclusion, I'd like to point out that there is no literary character more death positive than Queequeg, testing out his own coffin on the Pequod in Moby Dick. Yes.
This is my book, On the Road, by Jack Kerouac, which you might have heard of, which leads me to the spontaneous poem. What is this play I'm in? I don't even know the title. If I could only just rehearse one Wednesday in advance, or repeat a single Thursday that has passed. But here comes Friday with a script I haven't seen. Is it fair, I ask? My voice a little hoarse, since I couldn't even clear my throat off stage. It'd be wrong to think it's just a slapdash quiz taken in makeshift accommodation. Oh no. I'm standing on the set and I see how strong it is. The props are surprisingly precise. The machine rotating the stage has been around even longer. The furthest galaxies have been turned on. Oh no, there's no question. This must be the premiere, and whatever I do will become forever what I've done. I read Kerouac when I was in college, and I'm not sure if it grabs me as much as I did then, but it made me want to go out and be involved in the great external world. I remember taking a trip to Central America with some friends in an old car. And Kerouac was about spontaneity, so that's what Wasala Sobolka reminds me of. So in America, when the sun goes down and I sit on the old broken down river pier watching the long, long skies over New Jersey, and sense all that raw land that rose in one unbelievable huge bulge over to the West Coast, and all the road going, all the people dreaming of the immensity of it. And I now know that in Iowa the children are sleeping, and tonight the stars will be out. The evening star will be drooping and shedding her sparkler dims on the prairie, which is just before the coming of the complete night that blesses the earth, darkens all the rivers, cups the peaks, and folds the final shore, and nobody knows what's going to happen to anybody. And that's Jack Kerouac. Thanks.
Thank you, Michael, and Emily, and Renee. It's great that we have such a diversity of books today. And now I will share something. Recently at work, everyone filled out one of those get-to-know-you questionnaires, stuff like, how many kids do you have? What kind of sports do you like? Where did you grow up? And so on. One of the questions was, what is your favorite book? Two people, one being me, picked the same book. What are the odds of that? With all of the thousands of books that have been written during the history of the world, that in one random sample of people, two would share the same favorite book. I suppose the odds would depend on the popularity of the book and the average age and background of the sample. But I guess that doesn't really matter. The point is, we both picked Stephen King's famous horror novel, It. There are probably many, many differing opinions in the room about the quality of Mr. King's work. Obviously, his books are popular. Many, many millions sold. Dozens have been adapted into other mediums, such as graphic novels and films. But popular does not necessarily mean good. Lots of hugely popular books are generally recognized as trash. But really, that doesn't matter either. The topic today is favorite books, not necessarily best written books or the most important contributions to literature. So why does It top my list? I found this book to be amazingly entertaining, engaging, relatable characters put into an impossible situation. These characters must use their wits and courage to defeat a monstrous foe. At 1,078 pages, it's not King's longest. Under the Dome comes in at 1,483, but reading it is a commitment. It's a long, I like a long novel from time to time. It's like going on a real adventure. You get the chance to truly get to know the characters and like or dislike them as people. Later, when there is danger and suspense, the reader can truly feel the threat of evil and the joy of triumph. The lead characters in this novel are a group of underdogs. In the structure of the novel, we first meet them as adults, and in parallel episodes, we see them as young high school kids. In the two timelines, they are faced with a town that has been corrupted by an ancient evil force. The personification of this evil usually shows up in the form of a malevolent clown called Pennywise. Most kids have to put up with bullies, but in this fictional town of Derry, Maine, the bullies are under the influence of this timeless evil, and they are downright murderous. These lonely, picked-on kids, Bill, Mike, Richie, Beverly, Ben, Eddie, and Stan, find each other, and in that union, they discover their own strength. In my favorite chapter, called The Apocalyptic Rock Fight, our young heroes are on the run from a group of bullies, and when they find that they can take no more abuse, they decide to stand and fight. I will share some quotes from this chapter. It is way too long to read it all, but I will pick and choose some bits that convey the feeling. Plus, I will leave out the many, many expletives of questionable language. In this scene, Mike, the town's only black kid, is running from three bullies. He runs down into a wild area the kids call the Barrens. He picks up some chunks of coal. Begin quote. He stopped and picked up a couple of chunks. "This is for my dog, you bastard," Mike cried, unaware that he had begun to cry. He threw one of the chunks of coal overhand. It flew in a hard, direct line. It struck Henry's forehead with a loud bonk and then rebounded into the air. Henry stumbled to his knees. His hands went to his head. Blood seeped through his fingers at once, like a magician's surprise. The others skidded to a stop, their faces stamped with identical expressions of disbelief. Henry uttered a high scream of pain and got to his feet again, still holding his head. Mike threw another chunk of coal. End quote. This first counterattack served only to make the bullies angrier. Mike runs on and soon meets up with the other young losers. They quickly bond, and as the bigger kids rush toward them, they gather up their ammunition of stones, and the battle truly begins. An excerpt from that combat. Richie joined Bill and also began firing rocks at Moose. One of Richie's missiles split the skin above Moose's left eyebrow. Moose howled. Eddie and Stan moved up to join Bill and Richie. Beverly moved in with them, her arm bleeding but her eyes wildly alight. Rocks flew. Belch Higgins screamed as one of them clipped his crazy bone. He began to dance cumbersomely, rubbing his elbow. End quote. The bullies soon began to realize how serious the younger kids were. As they began taking more damage, they lost their bravado, and one by one, they decided to back down. One more quote. Bill turned toward Victor, their eyes locked, and Victor saw something in the stuttering kid's gaze that scared the hell out of him. Absurdly, the words, "I take it back," trembled behind his lips, except that was nothing you said to a little kid, not if you didn't want your buddies to start ranking you to the dogs and back. Bill started to walk toward Victor, and now Victor began to walk toward Bill. At the same moment, as if by some telepathic signal, they began to throw rocks at each other. Still closing the distance, the fighting flagged around them as the others turned to watch. Even Henry turned his head. Bill threw one rock after another, pegging them with murderous force. Bill was less than 5 feet from Victor now. "You get out of here now," he said, "or I am going to split your head open. I mean it." Looking into his eyes, Victor saw that he really did. Without another word, he turned and headed back the way Peter Gordon had gone. End quote. These images of usually helpless kids successfully facing down bullies was very inspirational to me. You might disagree with the level of violence in the book, but the message of finding courage, support, and even love in a group of like-minded folks resonated with me. This is a story of ordinary people facing down an extraordinary evil, a tale of courage, a tale of hope. In this day and age, a fantasy about everyday people being able to face up to and ultimately defeat a rampaging evil monster is the feel-good story of the century. And that was Stephen King's It.